You're listening to The Threshing Floor.
Once again to the Threshing Floor. I have with me Dr. Joseph Lumpkin, and we're going to cover a pretty wide spectrum of things on the show today, but I wanted to have him back to discuss in particular a couple aspects I thought we didn't cover or perhaps didn't cover in enough detail regarding the sacred feminine on the last show. And so we're going to touch on that. We're going to talk about a really interesting subject, something called the axial age and what happens as we shift in our cultures and our consciousness and our religious understanding. Welcome to the Threshing Floor, Joseph.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me again.
Joseph, the last time you were on, we talked about the sacred feminine in a lot of detail, and we generated some controversy with that, and we had questions as well. Maybe what we can do in the beginning of this segment is to kind of cinch up the apologetics on that a little bit and explain why we have to bring out the sacred feminine, what it actually means to us on this side of what we call the New Testament, and what is the representational aspects of the sacred feminine in regard to the deity of the Godhead?
The deity of the Godhead is everything. It is all-encompassing. It is all-powerful. It is all-knowing. It is both male and female. It is balanced. It is perfect. So for that to actually be what it is, there must be a male and a female matrix or energy or presence within the Godhead. So in the very beginning, the Jews had this right because Ruach was the spirit. And then that name, that word is a feminine word. And she is, or God is in that aspect, brooding over the chaos, brooding over the water. And she brings forth life. She is the mother. She is the mother of us all that gave birth to Mother Earth, you might say, and to us. She is also Shekinah. She is the Spirit of God. And so what happened to cancel her out was pretty significant switch. It went from Hebrew to Greek, where it became neuter. And then the word went from Greek to Latin, where it became male. And of course, when the Catholic Church propagated the Vulgate, the Latin Vulgate, everything was drawn from that. Then we had this overall idea that God is just male, whereas in the beginning it was supposed to be, in the Christian era, if it was understood by the Jews in that time, reading the Old Testament and relating it to what would become the New Testament, they understood that there was a mother aspect to God, a father aspect to God, and a birth given to the Trinity of the Godhead, Jesus Christ, who was the birth of spirit. So, you know, that is the...
So this is essentially a sacred family in terms of representationally father, mother, son.
Yes, that is exactly right. And they should have understood it that way, and I'm assuming they did. But by the time it got to us, it was not only neuter, but it was actually just an overall male type of Trinity. And that doesn't work out real well. So you had a lot of things going on. We tried to recapture the sacred feminine by mythology and substitution. And so we had these goddesses that were taking the place of what should have been the pure spirit of God. Ashra was one of them. And you will see little miniature representations of her a big-bosomed woman who is the mother god, and the inscriptions say to El his Ashtaroth, or his wife, and so we knew that at that particular time the Jews were basically polytheistic, trying to capture the family aspect of God by substituting Ruach with Ashtaroth, who was an idol. And so you had the goddess worship going on. Then, very slowly, you had this shift until all of a sudden it reached this, what we call the Axial Age, where everything's very, very rapidly. Ashtaroth was done away with, polytheism was done away with, the idea of just ceremony and just sacrifice was all done away with, and all of a sudden you had this push toward an individual communion with God going on all over the world. And that's what we call the Axial Age, starting in about 800 BC and going to about 200 BC. Every single religion in the world seemed to change at one time. It was a quantum entanglement that pulled the globe into a less outward religion, call it extroversion, into a subjective pull of an individual relationship and communion with God. Makes sense.
In your understanding, was this shift across the boundaries of different religions? For instance, we have Hinduism. Would we have had Buddhism at this point in time?
Yes, actually we did. Buddhism occurs between the 5th and 2nd century BCE. Okay. And that is, and Hinduism had the Upanishad and the Gita. The Gita was between the 2nd and 5th century BCE also. Zoroastrianism was between, it was around 300 to 100 BC. And there's some argument about that. The Jews that occurred between El and Yahweh, which we can discuss in some detail later if you wish, but El was a bull or a calf god, and he was a war god. And Yahweh, he was the patron god and the caretaker and the one that wanted a union with them. So he is the one that had the Ten Commandments going on with, you might say, a deal going on with the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. I will take care of you. You will worship me alone, and we will commune with each other. And I'm going to show myself to you, and I'm going to reveal myself to you, and I'm going to be in your spirit, and I'm going to guide you internally and externally. And that move came around 800 to 500 BCE. You had a lot of things going on at the same time. There's a religion called Jainism. Or Jainism. Yes. Mm-hmm. That came about at the same time, which heavily influenced Hinduism. Now, that religion was all about purification and sacrifice and the idea of reincarnation and all things being interconnected and interrelated. So they did not kill or harm any living thing, and they purified in hopes of achieving a union with God.
How closely does what we understand about the earliest period of Christianity tie in to this stream of ideas? In other words, there is obviously carryover from epoch to epoch. Would the earliest believers in Christianity have still understood this in your view?
They would have understood the idea of the sacred feminine. They were caught up in the very end of the Axial Age. Some people say that the Axial Age goes up until 100 AD so that they can include. I don't think so. I think what actually is going on here is that the idea of Jesus as God coming down and coming with man one-on-one and the hovering in and indwelling man is the prime zenith, the apex of the Axial Age, because that's where it was going. That was what was the idea of having God in me and me in God and achieving that enlightenment, if you will. That's where everything was headed.
So essentially we were moving from an age of ritualism and what I guess you would call sacrifice and to some level idolatry towards a more personified, personal, image of God. God manifests on the earth as man and basically entering into our space-time continuum to manifest, which changes the whole game in terms of our understanding of God.
Yes. The prime example of how this started, you can take Hinduism, for example. So the precursor of Hinduism was Brahmanism. It was almost like Levi-ism to us. It was a group of people who were priests who were doing sacrifice and ritual. And all of this, you have to understand, this is all external. This is all objective, not subjective. In other words, it has really nothing to do with putting yourself or viewing yourself as part of the whole. It is all external. Mm-hmm. So Jainism was a knee-jerk reaction to that. They said, no sacrifice. We will harm nothing living. We believe that everything is interconnected. To harm you is to harm me. It became kind of an internalization of God. I'm going to live as I think I would live. And instead of being objective, it was subjective. Mm. Now, you had mentioned before the bicameral mind and the idea of some kind of a leap consciousness.
Yeah, let me explain a little bit about this for the listeners, because I've actually discussed this on shows years ago. Basically, this is based on the theories of Professor Julian Jaynes from Princeton University. He was writing in the mid to late 1970s. The book was called The Origin of Consciousness in the Bicameral Mind, the bicameral mind being a two-chambered brain, and the idea that man essentially operated in a mode of consciousness in one epoch where he was effectively not self-conscious. He was not self-aware that his choices were made as a result of a very detached sense of consciousness, as opposed to what happened after that period of time, a very similar era to what we discussed in the Axial Age, where man became self-aware and self-conscious, and his actions were formed by an internal process. So that basically gives the listener a thumbnail sketch of what I was talking about with Julian
Jaynes. I disagree with the physiology that's discussed, because he says that part of the issue is that the two hemispheres were not talking, and we had this leap of evolution, and in that leap of evolution, we had these chatters now, these connections between the hemisphere, and all of a sudden you have this rise of consciousness. I disagree with that, but I agree with the theory, and you can prove this by saying, if you take the pathways between the right and left hemisphere in, for example, an epileptic, and you slice them to separate them, that epileptic does not go into a reverted mode of total objectivity and non-relation to its specifically, but not generally, because there must have been something going on. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. We talk now a lot about quantum entanglement. Let's take something, for example, that we know. We know that many, many years ago, otters did not know how to use rocks to break open the shells. We know that it started in a particular area.
Yeah.
All over the world, it began at the same time.
This is like the 100 monkeys theory, basically, right?
Yeah. Almost there was something in the ethers, if you will. There was some quantum entanglement, and otter number one started cracking open these shells, and then all of a sudden in Peru or wherever they were doing it too, in the same period of time. That is exactly what's going on with the rise of consciousness, and that's exactly what's going on with the shift into the axial age. My wife asked an interesting question. It was the chicken and egg thing. We perceive God differently, and that change our mind, or mind change in that precipitated a different outlook of God? And it's an interesting question. I tend to think that somehow we got the idea where we are in the universe. It clicked with us, and we said, oh my goodness, everything is interconnected. I'm part of a whole. God is alive and well and living in me.
Yeah. This goes into an area that I've discussed on Threshing Floor before, the idea of quantum physics, of quantum entanglement, the fact that we're dealing with a unified field, that we're dealing, and here again, we go back to James for a minute, and his theories. His theories were based on previous models of the brain, whereas I think modern neurophysiology, as well as the field of science in general, is more accepting now of non-locality. And again, you know, dealing with non-locality, we have to look at the fact that the brain itself is an organ, but it is not the locus of consciousness, which I think is key in understanding a lot of this, that what we're dealing with is something metaphysical.
Yes. There's a show that's actually on right now called Through the Wormhole, and it's an excellent science show if you get a chance. Well, they introduced a magnetic pulse into the brain of an unconscious person, and it appeared in the brain as a stimuli and died away. Then they did the same thing with a conscious person, and it rang through the brain like a bell resonating. It went around the pieces of the brain, talking to the pieces of the brain, and it wrapped around the brain, and then died away, showing there was an interconnectivity of the processes that were going on in the conscious mind, relating that to ourselves and ourselves to the outside world, and interconnecting all things. Now, what James said has to do with the hemispheres. It's probably incorrect, but the idea of this resonating brain, the idea of everything interconnecting, that could there could be something right with that.
So I guess the question becomes, why are we discussing this and how does it connect with us living here in the 21st century in a time when I think we're going through incredible changes both culturally, spiritually, and in terms of our understanding of the universe, which reflects back again to our theology?
Well, I believe, and a lot of people believe, that the axial age is coming again. If you look at things that have happened in the last 100 years, the ideas of how human beings relate to one another and relate to God, they're changing. Now, I don't want to sound skeptical or cynical, but I'll just say it the way that I feel it. Religion is dying. Spirituality is waking up. Religion is dying because we no longer want the formula. We no longer want the dog and pony show. We are beginning to that the rantings and ravings of the street corner preacher and the condemnation coming out of that is the same fundamental judgmentalism as is going on in fundamental Islam, for example, or any other religion that is exclusive and condemning. Now, we can discuss the growth within the human being because everyone has a choice to enter their own individual axial age. We have it in us to transcend this. Martin Buber wrote a book called I and Thou, and he explained that there are ways of communicating, and I think it's the same way that we communicate with God,
yes,
as we communicate with one another. He said, and I'm going to paraphrase him, he said there's a me and the other mode where you're talking to your wife or your significant other and you speak to them like they are an extension of you. Go and pick up the kids and I will do this and I'll meet you back here and so forth. Then there's another stage. And by the way, that's the way we usually live our lives. Then there's another stage of, let's call it you and me. And that is when we sit down like you and I are sitting down,
sure,
right now. We discuss it. We discuss these things and we exchange ideas. But there's some little something in the back of our minds that go, yeah, you've almost got it right, but I've got it right. Or, yeah, you know, in other words, we're not spiritually equal. But then there is a state of grace that occurs out of nowhere called I and Thou. And when we speak to one another, we are speaking to the beloved. And we are not only equal, but we are the same. And we treat each other that way. And there's a spiritual awakening within the relationship. And that is where we're going, I think, religiously to spiritually also. I don't know if that makes sense to take those two ideas and show how they're interconnected. But that evolution spiritually is where we're going.
We're sitting here having a pretty spontaneous conversation right now. And it's interesting that you brought up Martin Buber. I read Martin Buber when I was maybe 16 or 17 years old. It was one of those books in that particular era of growing up that was impactful in terms of kind of stretching out of my own fundamentalist upbringing and kind of moving towards a different form of spirituality. And we're of an age where we grew up in that period when things were being stretched. America, the Western world especially, in the 1960s, the 1970s, went through a revolution. And don't think that can be, I don't think that's an overstatement.
No, and the genie cannot be put back in that bottle.
No, and the stressors on the system were very squarely in the realm of the spiritual. You had this huge movement that shifted things towards Eastern mysticism, Eastern religions. We had a pop culture that completely embraced what we consider to be foreign spiritual systems, the Beatles at that time, going to India with the Maharishi. And in general, what we began to see was an onslaught against the Western models of spirituality. It's clear that people were searching. The drug culture being what it was, at its core, it began with people who were questioning consciousness and were attempting to break out of their established conscious system. Timothy Leary at Harvard, the other experiments, and then there's the dark side of that, because obviously those drugs were being brought in by, let's say, black operatives of governments as well. So there's a dark side all around on this. But we stretched the model, and I think as a result of that, we as a generation grew up with a more expansive view of spirituality as opposed to a dogmatic religion.
I believe that that's probably where the second axial age started. You know, the age of Aquarius or whatever it may be termed to you. But now we are standing on this precipice where people are falling away from organized religion mm-hmm. because it doesn't give them what they need. It doesn't answer the innermost question. It's not God's will that something happens badly to you. You know, it's not, gee, he's trying to teach you a lesson. The bunny foo-foo God picking up Phil Mouse and bopping him on the head is gone. It's dead. We are sitting on this edge, and we can step off of it and go, yes, you are there, you are alive, and you're well. Now, there's an idea of being a hero in your own myth, you might say, the hero in your own life. The word hero is about piercing the veil. Yes. And that veil has been described as a kind of plastic, elastic thing that when you go through it for good.
Oh, that's interesting.
But you push against it and you push against it and you push against it, and then finally it may break. We see it all the time. The four-minute mile. In our lifetime, the four-minute mile was the veil. And the moment that one person did it, lining up now, it's no big deal. But in 1954, I believe it was,
a guy hit
359, and from that point on, it's carried on, and they're getting faster and faster. The same thing is going to happen here,
Jim Ryan.
Spiritually. The veil is about to be pierced. Yeah. You know, Jesus said, greater works than me will you do. Well, the moment that we can pierce that veil and get to the state that he was in, and I'm not saying that we're supposed to be the same substance as Jesus. The hypostasis between us and Jesus can be argued all day long. But that same spiritual level of that he was trying to bring us up to, we reach that, the veil will be broken. And we will do the same thing that he did. We will say, look, this is Phariseeism. I don't have to tithe to pay you. I don't have to tithe to keep the lights open to this billion-dollar church, this crystal cathedral that cost millions and millions of dollars. That was your project, not mine. I don't have to pay your million-dollar salary. I don't have to buy your Mercedes. And locally, I'm speaking, I don't have to pay for your permanence and your new hairdos either. And that's for the preacher, not his wife. What's going on around here? And the dog and pony show will die away. And at that particular point, we will have reached that second axial age because we will have God in us at all times. And we will not have to go worship. and we will be able to commune like you and I are communing now.
I think for those of us who have kind of broken out of the church system, it's been difficult because we are kind of forerunners right now of something. Most people, and I see this continuously in what I do, I'm in contact with a lot of people, and I have been for the 7 years that I've done this show. I've seen what it's taken for people to break out of religion, and truthfully, we all carry that with us in a vestigial form. But I want to draw you back a little bit to greater things than these, because this is something I've grappled with, and I take it, I guess, almost literally, because I do believe that what Jesus came to do was to show us who we were and what we could be, that he was a typology of the age that we're now entering in. Is that a fair assessment, or do you differ with me?
No, I think that's very fair. When the Pharisees were arguing with him about his claim to godhood, he quoted Psalms to them. Hasn't it been said that we're all gods? You are all gods. Well, you know, that can be a little G instead of a big G. But his point was, God breathed into us and made us a living soul. That's where we get the word inspired from. We are inspired. We are breathed in, for we have creativity in us. When a person is inspired, they create. So if that creativity is music, yeah, or healing, it really doesn't make much difference. It is the same basic inspiration. And I think that's what he was getting to. A lot of my friends say, well, you know, God never heals an amputee. Well, right, when that veil is pierced, we will know we're there. Right. We have to.
Right. This is, yeah. And see, that is a barrier right now, because we've not seen limbs regenerated yet. But that's, I have to wonder, based on my own experiences in life, just the normal human stuff, if it is because we have not stretched our faith far enough yet, if we have not tested the limits of our own understanding enough to even be able to conceive of that. Because like the 4-minute mile, the 5-minute mile, it's a barrier that's not been broken yet. It's part of that push that we've not made.
Yes, that's right. We haven't made it. We're not there yet. We have to keep pushing at the veil. It is, to me, the same kind of step as between the idol worshippers going on with sacrifice and cutting themselves and wailing and calling on their God. And the idea that even back in, 500 years before then said, though I make my bed in hell, you're there. An absolute faith.
So really, we know, and I think, most Christians have believed that we were headed for something. We were headed for a new era. Most of what I've seen for the last 10 years in my journey has been the modern form of what's called biblical prophecy, which has largely been gloom and doom. The expectation of a planet on a collision course with hell, that it was necessary to burn this rock down so that we could have this new heaven, this new earth, and that basically, let me just be very blunt, God's really pissed off. And I swam in that for so long. And I honestly reached a point about 18 months ago where I began to go, wait a minute, is this true? Is this all there is? Or are we just living in this constant drama that's been brewed up by the way Scripture has been interpreted? We've never talked about this before. I'd like to get your input on it.
It is a amalgam of taking different books. You have to view the Bible as a library, not a book. Different times, different people, different reasons. So you had Thessalonians going, well, two will be on the rooftop and one will be taken. Two in the middle grinding, one will be taken. If you put that in historical context, that is exactly what was going on. That city was being buffeted. It was being brutalized by large stones being hurled by catapults. They were trying to break down that city at the time. And sure enough, you would be right beside your wife in the field, gleaning, and poof. Put it in historical context, it kind of makes sense. It does not relate to the rapture. Now, the return of Jesus, even Paul was waiting for the return of Christ. But we didn't even have the rapture in our vocabulary until a couple of hundred years ago. So, you know, you have to define what is... a book was written in Spain, and it was a Left Behind series of its day. And
Emmanuel Lacunza, I believe, was
yes,
that it?
And he was a propagator of it. And so you had this great idea, and some of the theologians at the time said, "Wow, that's really great. That is grist for the mill when I preach, because it's a compelling story. It's a great myth, and it became part of our vocabulary." And it should never.
I guess what I meant, and the rapture is one aspect to this, but even more than that is the fatalism that I see in the lives of evangelicals today, because they're waiting for a world to basically crash and burn. To me, this became somewhat inimical to the idea of faith, that we're so fatalistic that we think this is what's necessary. And it dovetails as well into what we talked about earlier in this conversation, the idea that there is a divinity within us. And I don't want to push this too far, but there is a co-creative aspect of us and our consciousness and how we interact with our world and expectations. You look at the world right now, and you and I talked about this in an email exchange, just very briefly. The world of Islam believes in a violent taking of the world. Jesus said in Scripture that until the time of John the Baptist, the violent were taking the kingdom of heaven. It seems like he was not preaching a violent taking in his time, nor did he advocate that. But we see the ripples in the political field right now of a very quickly moving, I guess what you would call right-wing conservative movement that's very politically active, that advocates some specific things. And what I have seen and what I have talked about on my shows for years has largely been a warning that Christianity was never intended to pick up the sword and the shield again and go to war, that we had a faith standing in this world to stand with God.
I think that's true, but you have to be very careful. You know that my family business is, we run several bail bonding companies. Yep. And so I see this thing world, you know, just around me, around the world here, every day, where sometimes violence is the answer because evil must be restrained.
Yes.
Now, having said that, I want to touch on a couple of things real quickly. Islam is around 1,400 years old. I believe that religions evolve and mature the same as people.
Yes.
This is called Joseph's theory,
yes,
of religion. I don't care. But if you look at where we were, the Cathar bloodbath happened in around 1290. The church sent in the Templars and other warriors to kill an entire city. The siege lasted 2 years. The men finally gave up trying to save the women and children. They burned the men alive, then attacked the women and children. That lasted another 6 months. They set fire to their clothes, and they watched them burn, screaming to death. And the reason was that the general over the siege said, "Kill everything. God will know his own." Now, the Crusades didn't really stop. They lost their momentum then because of the just horrible bloodbath, and people got sick of the blood. But they really carried on in the 1600s. Now, having said all this, what I'm trying to say is those were swords and spears. If radical Islam is not stopped, this world will come undone because they have biological weapons, nuclear weapons, all kinds of weapons of mass destruction that they can get a hold of. Listen, and this is really important. If your listeners don't get anything else, they've got to get this. Jihad happens inside. When Islam takes the axial age and becomes internalized, they will understand that the jihad that they should be fighting is in the heart, to eradicate sin within themselves first, just like we are called to. You know, my eye has to be examined before I pull the mote out of yours. my heart has to be examined before I tell you what to do. And Islam is immature. And if the leaders don't get a hold of this, there will be a knee-jerk reaction, and they're not going to like it, because we've got to protect ourselves. Because if they try to kill us, we have to protect our children. Now, there was a wonderful quote that said, we didn't go to war with Russia because we found out that the Russians loved their children as much as we loved ours. When we reach that with Islam, things will change. Jihad has to take care of itself internally first. That was what was supposed to happen worldwide on the Axial Age.
So I guess the question is, we walk the fine line between defending what is noble and what is right, but at the same time, not propagating any further discord by advancing our own agenda. And the reason I say that is because there are movements afoot in the world, and Zionism is one of them. I don't know how you feel about this. I have complete love for Jewish people, for the Hebrew culture, but I believe there is a zealousness that is inherent in Zionism that's very dangerous. It is almost the co-equal with jihad in terms of the passions it arouses, not necessarily in terms of its correctness or incorrectness. So I see this almost, this point coming together where the two hit each other. And I think that's the tipping point for all of this. Do we reach that point, and are we as a race able to make the decision, no, we do not drop nukes for our God or for your God?
Add one more leg to that to make a triangle. I do not see any difference between the rantings and ravings and spitting and foaming at the mouth of the Christian preachers that are propagating hate and judgmentalism and standing on corners and large churches spilling out hate. I don't see any difference between their fundamentalism, Zionism, and fundamentalist Islam. It is the same seed growing in our souls. And when we get past that and we understand that it is my personal revelation that I keep to myself that is my God, and my God is the same as yours, but the revelation may be different, and the way that I view him or her or it may be different, but it is the same creative force. It must be. There is only one. When we come to that, that we can pull back and go, you don't have to believe what I believe, because if there is love, if there is creativity, if there is inspiration, if your God, my God, lives inside of you, inside of me, that we are, as Martin Buber wants us to be, speaking I and thou. You are the beloved, because the beloved lives in both of us.
And I guess in terms of the Axial Age and in terms of our spiritual walk, we almost have now a burden within ourselves to change and to begin to seek God for an outward change as well as intercessors. That is really where I kind of stand right now in terms of, again, this is what I meant by being co-creators. I'm not saying we create realities. I'm saying that we cooperate with God in terms of his vision for our future, where we can fight God over that.
Yes. Jesus did miracles because he saw them done in heaven first. I mean, that literally is what the text says. I do what I see my Father do. So he was following, not leading. And when we can look into the Father's eyes, so to speak, and see what he wants to do, with that, we are co-creators. Now, we know through experimentation that for some unknown reason, we don't know why. Take photons, for example. When we look at them, they look like they are particles. When we don't look at them, they look like they're waves. And so we know with all these experimentations that we really do change reality at a quantum level. And that will eventually, like the butterfly effect, change the overall reality of things. So we are co-creators in a way. But there was an interesting book written many, many years ago by a theologian. Was that Chinese? Watchman Nee. Watchman Nee. And he speaks of the difference between soulish power and spirit power. And what he says basically is, yeah, we have God in us. And you better be really, really careful, because if you believe and you want badly enough, that soulish power, God in you, directed by you, your wants Watchman and your Nee. Lusts and everything else, will bring things into existence. You will take the opportunity given to you to bring that into existence, but that may not be the will of God. And then you go and do it, not the other way around. Yes, we do. We do. We've got to stop. First of all, we've got to stop fighting amongst ourselves. We've got to lay down our need to have other people be like us. All these splits within the church per... I saw in this neighborhood a Church of Christ split because they could not agree on how long to leave the water in the baptismal. Because if you're Church of Christ, of course, you believe that if your preacher baptizes you, complete submersion, that actually is part of your salvation, because you're following, you know, the water must have some spiritual power. And we can argue all of this, but it's just an idea that I'm throwing out there to say we really do strain at gnats and swallow camels. And that's what's wrong with us right now as a church, as a belief system, as a religion. And I hate the word religion. I really do. It conjures up to me the killings of we have to step out of the church and become Christians, Christ ones, ones yeah. owned by Christ, ones attached to Christ. We are not denominations. We are Christ ones. We have to take that leap.
So I guess in recognizing this, and we're, you know, we are talking about consciousness, and we're talking on one level about the fact that we have much more capacity, more power within us than we recognize. And as a result of that, now we have an awesome responsibility as well. I sense that we've kind of covered a pretty broad path here, but anything else you'd like to bring up at this point? Anything that's on your heart or on your mind?
Well, I was literally kind of dreading this, because there is so much to cover. This conversation has to range between literally physiology, psychology, and theology. And you try to put those together in some kind of a format to make things make sense. I'll throw this out just as a point of reference. We know that Darwinian evolution can't be right. We know that evolution's right, but we know that Darwinian evolution is not correct. We don't take these small steps in a lot of ways. Sometimes it gets to a point that there is a huge step. For example, go through a rat becoming a bat. There'll be a point where it can't fly and it can't walk. It doesn't work. If you look at the neck of the giraffe, it has to be in proportion to the legs. Everything has to do at the same time, and that just doesn't work. Evolution-wise, it falls apart. But what we now know is that we are put together like Legos, that a change in a certain gene won't change just one little thing sometimes. It changes entire structures, and that evolutionary idea actually works. What I'm getting at is, what if the axial age and the expansion of the mind was a leap in evolution that was so subtle we can't detect it? Besides, we can't go back and look at the soft tissues back then anyway. It wouldn't have to be much, just a couple of neurons. And all of a sudden you have a worldwide epidemic, if you will, of a new human way of looking at the world. And what if this is going to happen again? To live in a world where you are expecting destruction, where you want out, where you are begging God, mm-hmm. come now, wipe us all out. That's a hell of a way to live. It's a very negative way of living. You know, we are told, occupy till he comes. Well, that not sitting on your butt. That's the word for occupation. Work till he comes. And we're not doing that. We are forecasting and predicting, yes. And therefore we live like gloom and doom.
Yeah.
What if we were just to change our way of viewing it? Every day, this is a gift. Gratitude is the only thing that holds us to God. Gratitude is it. Gratitude acknowledges grace. Gratitude acknowledges life. It acknowledges the gift. It acknowledges the fact that we are here. And if you think about it, if everything really was done in this 6 days, then billions of souls are in the Gulf waiting for birth, and we were given the chance. What a gift.
I think, as probably Martin Buber and others brought out, this idea of the sacredness within us is something that we inherently need to begin to honor. Differences aside, I've seen, like you have, I've lived through church splits, I've lived through seeing denominations that were literally absorbed into other denominations. I watched the church that I grew up in collapse as a result of adultery and divorce. And I watched my own faith as a result of that plummet. And I think that recognizing that in the foibles and follies of human beings, there is a sacredness that transcends our human flaws. And getting past that and recognizing what you've talked about, a consciousness shift, may not be this long, protracted process any longer, but it may actually be, I guess, kind of like this point in time and space where man makes the decision. And, you know, I've had conversations with people from many different spiritual paths. And nearly universally, what we talk about is that it is a small minority of people on the earth at any given time that shift occurs in, and it then becomes widespread.
They were at one time called the Desert Fathers. They were the Christian mystics in our religion. I believe that this really is, you know, every church thinks that they are the remnant that God is keeping alive.
Yeah.
No. No, there are a few heroes. There are a few people going out there pushing at the veil, poking at the veil. They're the remnant. They're the ones that will take us forward. They're the ones that will show us what's possible. And let me say this really quickly. The sacred feminine is very important.
Yes.
Because women have been so ostracized and so cut away from the church. And they didn't need to be. Because from the very beginning, John, for example, says to the lady, to the elect lady and her children. Yeah. Well, that's her name. That's not a title. No, I've been told for years that was the church and the members. Yeah. No, her name was Electa. Her name actually was the elect lady, just like my name is Joseph, which means he shall add. And, you know, you try to live up to your name, Joseph Burton, he shall add a bright light. Well, let's hope so. Let's hope. But Electa was a pastor. John didn't have a problem with that. The sacred feminine is that touchstone that the females need, the women need to know that God is male and female, that there is a, and I'm going to get spanked for this, that Christianity has got us, that there is a female force in us and in God, just as there is a male force within us and within God, and we have that entire matrix, and we need to find that balance within each of us and relate to that and know that He creates. There's different types of creativity. There is the creativity of He created the world. Then there's a bringing forth. It's the female force, the brooding. He gives birth, and she nurtures our soul, and He creates, and He encompasses and empowers. Because if you have power without compassion, you're a brute. If you have dominance, role, and nurturing, you're a brute. We've been brute long, and we need to encompass both the male and female within ourselves. And the women out there need to make sure that they connect with that also. They've been changed.
Absolutely. You have a new book out, and I want to touch on it because it goes right to the heart of the subject discussing, the sacred feminine. Tell us a little bit about the new book.
It's been out for a couple of months. You can get it through Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It used to be Borders, but I think Borders is no longer with us, really. The Sacred Feminine is called Searching for the Hidden Face of God. That's the subtitle of it. And it takes us through the times that the Jews were polytheistic and how they missed the point to begin with and drifted away and ended up coming back. And it's the story of and data. There's a lot of data in it about how words were changed within the scriptures and reinterpreted to dismiss the women. Phoebe is called a servant, but the word is exactly the same as a deacon. She's a deaconess. The elect lady is actually the name of the woman, and she was a pastor. And so from the very beginning, you had women who were, according to the New Testament, actually funding Jesus, actually the first to be at the tomb, the first to acknowledge his resurrection, one of the first people to be deacons, the first people, women were among the first people to be pastors, to have all of this going on in their house. And I don't know how we got, well, yes, I do, because it's all about control, isn't it? So we sliced them away, and we executed this, I don't know, estrangement of half of our population when it was never supposed to be so.
There's a lot of power in what we've talked about, and it links back to the original conversations we had, the idea that, yes, history, and yes, the scriptures as we now know them have been altered. Many people will say that we are subversives, and I might not disagree with them because I think subversion can be a good thing in the name of truth. Maybe just as we close out here, tell me how you feel about your role in bringing out this material and really laying a lot of material back out into the public record that's been lost and altered for a long time. Your purpose behind that?
Well, yeah, I guess it is subversion. Personally, this is how I view it. I think that Jesus came and died for all of us. That means the entire world. I'm sorry, even your enemies, and I'm afraid probably even Muslims too. But He died for all of us, and we are imperfect. So that means that if I'm wrong, I'm still forgiven, and if you're wrong, you're still forgiven. And you may not want to look at what we're talking about, but there's a bigger truth out there, a larger truth out there. And even if you don't believe it, you still get to be with Him. He's in you and you in Him. But don't be conservative. Conservatism wants to keep things exactly the same. And you have to acknowledge one thing. It's not working. It's not working. One time a few years ago, before the Methodist Church started their huge push of open minds and open hearts, they were losing one church in the U.S. every week. It was closing and being sold. They were dying as a faith. And now they're okay, they're stable, because they've got one hell of an ad campaign. And that's really what I'm talking about, is that your religion right. should not be based on an ad campaign. It should be based on something that works. And so let's go back to what works. And what was the first century when we were not in churches, but in people's homes, and we were talking among ourselves. You know, I talked a little bit about China having this amazing push, and Christianity is reaching a kind of critical mass there. But they're doing it under pressure. They're doing it in squalor. They're doing it where the authorities don't want to come. They're meeting in sewers and pig pens, and they're preaching and teaching in the corners full of feces, and they're growing. Christianity survive better under the thumb of its enemy than in the placid acceptance of his friends, to quote Garrison Keillor. And we can't take ourselves too seriously. You know, we talk, and it's really, really serious, because truth really is serious. But when it comes right down to it, I know that I don't know, and I know that you don't know. And what really pisses me off is people who think they know, and I know they don't know. So, and to quote Robin Williams, angels have wings because they take themselves lightly, and we should also. So having talked about all of this stuff, and it's really heavy stuff, very dense material here, a lot of stuff going on, quantum physics to God. I mean, you can't span anything greater than that to subatomic to infinite. And yet, in all of this, we're just reaching for the truth. It's a goal. We haven't gotten it.
And I think in that, we need to keep our humility and keep our humor and a sense of purpose that's a little bit beyond what we can understand, because that's what keeps us reaching.
Yes. Never assume that we have it. Everybody that gets always thinks that they have reached the end. As a matter of fact, every step in my walk until recently, I've always said, I got it. This is it. I've attained it. I'm so arrogant. You know? And finally, at the age of 56, you go, you know, I know from the past this is just another little baby step, and there's probably another horizon to go over, and we keep pushing.
I think I may have said this in an email to you. I'm more comfortable now with ambiguity than I've ever been. I'm okay with the fact that there's a lot I don't know, because there's so much I'm seeing, the processing, it's a full-time job anyway. I think in a lesson in all of this, and I this is why I'm so grateful for the work that you've done in bringing these books back, is it's time to say it's okay for us to look at this, and it's time for us to say it's okay to have stuff there that we're not comfortable with. I'm okay with that, because I close the show out, I always say the truth is out there, it's inside you, and I think as we pull this in, we also have to be willing to bail some of it. What I like to say as well is chew hard and spit out bones, because there's some bones here.
Oh, absolutely. There are things that you've got to get rid of that aren't truth, because we don't know. The theory that we're talking about with the intercommunication of the brain has probably been disproven to a certain degree. Spit out that bone, but you keep the major concept because you know something's happening out there. I love that I saw, you know, I'm a geek. I used to be a Department of Defense analyst, and I used to have a poster from the X-Files that said, the truth is out there, it's just not well indexed.
They needed a data analyst to take care of that. I think we're going to close it out with that. This has been a really, really interesting conversation. I almost feel like we're posting a private conversation, but in a lot of ways, maybe that's what we do. So, Joseph, I want to thank you for coming on again. I want to thank you for sharing and for being so open and candid. And I don't think I have anything else I want to add to this conversation right now. I think we'll just put this on the record. This is The Threshing Floor. You can find us at threshingfloor-radio.com. I'm Randy Moggins. The truth really is out there, and it really is inside you as well. We'll be back again with another show very soon. Come on. Who plays God upon the barricades?
life is just a fading day. Here I am with so many questions without answers. A boy alone with God to find out where he stands. I looked for Jesus on the barricades. To give one's life is sometimes what it takes. Life is just a flick of light. Day is just a child of night. Come out of your otherworldly temples. Lay down your evidence into these temples. The holy houses with your finest samples. Touch darkness now and give me answers. Give me answers. Come out of your other world with temples. Lay down. Just a child of night.